Robert Fisk has been reporting from the Middle East for over four decades. Afghanistan, Iran, the occupied territories, Israel, Iraq. And from Northern Ireland in his early career for The Times and The Independent since 1989. His writing has a kind of savage indignation that is based on on-the-ground observation. And a new documentary captures both. It's called This Is Not a Movie. It's directed by Canadian Yung Chang. It'll be part of the Doc Edge Festival, which will be online this year. Details on our webpage. It starts next month. Robert Fisk is the world's most decorated foreign correspondent. His criticism of the United States and the UK and his sympathy for the Palestinians has often been polarizing. And he's with me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Where are you?
I'm actually just outside Dublin in Ireland. So I'm looking out upon the sea with beautiful clouds and a rainbow. A long way from Beirut, but it's not a bad place when you're finishing a book.
A long way from Beirut. Very green, I imagine. It's astonishing, really, that you are still alive.
Yes. Some years ago, I was traveling in a taxi down the Corniche in Beirut towards my home, and the driver, whom I remembered from the Civil War, which of course lasted from 75 to 1990, turned round to me at one point and he said, "You're very lucky to be alive, Mr. Robert." And I said, "So are you." And a very dear friend next to me said, "Robert, you are very lucky." Although, of course, at the time, when you sort of escape with your life from episodes that are obviously very dangerous, you try to sort of say, well, okay, now I'm going to write my story, now I'm going to go out to dinner, and tomorrow is another day. But when you look back, yes, I think, you know, if I had a guardian angel, it would probably long ago have asked for trade union status, put it that way.
Do you make a sort of cost-benefit analysis of things that you go into?
Yes, I think, well, nowadays probably more than I did. I think, for example, look, is this story worth it? By story, I mean, is this historical event which I'm going to cover worth it? Is it worth risking your life for? You obviously don't go on a suicide mission. You're going there to report, not to die, whether it be Syria or Egypt or, you know, quote, Palestine, unquote, or whether it be in the Gulf or wherever, or Iran or Afghanistan. You know, in the old days, when I say the old days, I mean 30 years ago when I was, say, in the Beirut, the siege of Beirut, which was being shelled every day, all night by the Israelis and around my home as well. I think, you know, I used to have this rather horrible equation. If when I was going out and getting into the car to go off to some scene of horror, if I drove faster, I would be out in the open for less time and was therefore safer. But the faster I drove, the more places I would go to, and therefore, would I be safe after all? I've never actually worked out that equation to find out what the answer is, but one did tend to live like that. Nowadays, when you go off to a war, say in Syria, you have a week of pretty intense or 2 weeks of pretty intense work and danger. You know, you're in danger during the day. You've got to write late into the evening to file your report to London, the Independent in my case. And then very often there's so much noise at night from shell fire, explosions, that it's very difficult to sleep. So while you're going through this constant weighing out of danger, which means questions like, do I drive across this road now? Do I run? Do I walk? Or do I stay where I am? You are becoming increasingly daily more tired. And of course, it's I've often thought that it tends to be towards the end of an assignment that journalists get hurt or killed, because I think they're getting exhausted.
Are there places now that you would not go?
No, there's no. Well, I wouldn't go to Idlib because ISIS is there. And ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, as we know, has rewarded journalists by cutting off their heads on video and displaying their decapitated corpses for their families to see. And therefore, I don't think that is worth the risk for the story. But apart from areas controlled by ISIS, there's nowhere I wouldn't go, providing I could get a visa. At the moment, visas for me are impossible to get to Saudi Arabia and to Bahrain, but I think they're the only countries which I can't travel to. I can get to Syria, I can get to Iraq, I live in Lebanon, I can go to Israel, I can go to, quote, Palestine, unquote, and Afghanistan. So there's only two places I can't get to and one I wouldn't go to.
And Saudi Arabia won't give you a visa because?
Because I have long been a critic of the autocracy and dictatorship of the Wahhabi Saudi royal family. I was not, you know, my feelings towards Saudi Arabia didn't warm very much when Saudi officials murdered a colleague of mine, Jamal Khashoggi, whose name you'll know well. In fact, Jamal used to be a very close friend of mine and was the man who actually invited me to meet Osama bin Laden for the first time, because he knew bin Laden before I did. And he took me into the desert in Sudan and said, I think, Sheikh Osama, you'd better meet Robert Fisk. So Jamal Khashoggi was the man who introduced me to bin Laden. But Jamal and I had known each other. We'd spent some days on family holidays when he'd been in Egypt. So I knew him pretty well. And I felt great disgust when I found that the Americans were prepared to excuse Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, even after the CIA had said he must have been personally aware that this murder was going to take place. Not that I trust the CIA, but I think the Saudis, I think the so-called Arab revolution will end up in Saudi Arabia, not people in vast numbers fighting each other, but it'll be a squabble between all the princes and the royal family. But no, I would love to go back to Saudi Arabia, but I cannot get a visa and will not be given one.
Just talking about Khashoggi for a moment, the latest story on that is that a UN investigator has predicted that Saudi Arabia will eventually release the convicted killers of Mr. Khashoggi after the killers were said to have been forgiven by Khashoggi's sons in a move that she has said represented the kingdom's absolute impunity.
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty accurate. You know, when the sons accepted effectively blood money for the murder of their father, I thought it was only a matter of time before they would make some formal forgiveness to the murderers. If the murderers have been identified to them, that would be interesting to know. I think possibly I'm a bit surprised that they didn't therefore ask, can you show me where the body of our father is? One would perhaps, a loyal son in forgiving a murderer might ask where the murderer has dumped the father's body. But obviously that was not asked, possibly because his corpse was disposed of with chemicals, but possibly because if you live in Saudi Arabia and you have your home there and your money there, it's not a question you would ask.
So Khashoggi's son Salah has said, this is a statement on Twitter as things are these days, He says, sons of the martyr Jamal Khashoggi, we announce that we forgive and pardon those who participated in the killing of our father. If you forgive and make reconciliation, as the Quran says, the reward is due from God. How do you feel about that?
Well, if they're going to forgive the murderers, it would be interesting to know if they'd like to identify the murderers to those of us who knew their father. But I think, once you've given in to a despot, your capitulation is total. It's not about what the Quran says or what the Bible would say if you'd say this in a different society. Once you've decided that even though you don't know where the murderers have put your father's body, you're going to forgive them. That's the end, really, isn't it? I mean, there's nothing more to be said.
One of the least reported wars is the one that's going on in Yemen, of course, with heavy Saudi Arabian involvement. Do you think that more attention should be paid to that?
Yes, I think, I think more attention should be paid to many other battles in the Middle East.
Well, especially
Syria,
now,
where
with COVID-19 is dominating everything. Who knows what's going on out there?
Yes, but you see, there's an interesting question about COVID-19. I keep reading, and my colleagues keep pointing out that, the wars in the Middle East have devastated these people to the extent that COVID-19 is going to rip through the populations and destroy them. They're going to find themselves under this appalling death toll of coronavirus deaths. And yet, with the exception of Iran, most Middle East countries appear to have not been affected in the way that we predicted. Now, of course, you can say there are people being buried which are not being advertised. In other words, there are secret burials, possibly in Egypt. But you can't bury tens of thousands of people in secret. It's too big. Not even the Syrians, who used to mass graves, could do that. I noticed, for example, that I don't think Gaza has had a single death. Israel's had more than 200. I haven't seen any figures to suggest that COVID-19 has taken a very large number of lives in Yemen. Certainly, there have been a number in Iraq, but not on the scale that we were told. You remember all these stories that in the Palestinian refugee camps of Lebanon, in the Syrian refugee camps of northern Syria and southern Turkey, there was going to be an outbreak of this pandemic on a size we'd never seen before. And yet it hasn't happened. You know, I've talked to a number of people who have friends who are doctors, and in two cases, actual medical doctors from the region, and asked why it is that, in fact, strangely enough, despite this complete collapse of society, you know, the collapse even of health societies, you know, hospitals, medical clinics, and so on, how it is that coronavirus hasn't struck in the way which we all feared. One reason that was suggested to me was that such a large proportion of the population is young, that they don't have the same percentage of elderly people as, say, Western countries do or richer countries. I'm not sure if that is the answer. Is it perhaps because they have lived in such terrible conditions? I mean, look at the people who have to live in the squalor of Karachi or Dhaka in Bangladesh, and indeed in Mumbai. And yet it seems the pandemic has not struck them with the horrific scale that many people predicted and everybody, including themselves, feared. Is it because they've lived in such terrible circumstances that there is some immunity? I simply don't know. I just make that point because a colleague of mine in Beirut was making this point to me yesterday, that he's very surprising that richer countries appear to have suffered more than the poorer and war-struck countries about whom we've exercised quite genuinely our fears.
Interesting.
But yes, going back to your original point, yes, Yemen should be covered. Syria should be covered again. Syria now sort of comes up every time there's a hospital bomb by the Syrian military or when ISIS executes someone, and then it fades away again. And of course, I think one of the great sadnesses or indeed tragedies of the coronavirus pandemic is that the whole Middle East tragedy, if you like, of injustice and dispossession and blood has basically faded away from all of us who you know, who are concentrating on our own families or our own countries or so on. And we've largely forgotten that long after COVID-19 is in the history books, the same terrible history will continue in these regions and will continue to kill many people, much more than coronavirus will.
We're going to be talking to David Simon later in the program about his adaptation of Philip Roth's counterfactual history, The Plot Against America, where Lindbergh, you know, becomes president. I just wondered, given your belief that the troubles in the Middle East are almost entirely due to the post-World One boundary that were drawn up not only in the Middle East but Yugoslavia and Northern Ireland, I wonder whether you were ever tempted to attempt a counterfactual history of the Middle East.
I'm not quite sure what counterfactual history means.
What if? Look, what if those boundaries hadn't been drawn after World War One?
Yeah, look, I think World War One was going to end in the downfall of empires, and the downfall of empires was going to end in a fake peace treaty, which is what Versailles was. I always feel drawn to it because my father, not my grandfather, but my actual father, who was much older than my mother, was a soldier in the First World War. He was in the Third Battle of the Somme in 1918. And therefore, I tend to feel that Versailles was his peace treaty. I don't say I blamed him for it, but I certainly felt that, you know, he has a, or he had when he was alive, I have it now, I have a a war medal he was given for all survivors of the First World War. And it's interesting. It says the Great War for Civilization, 1914 to 1919. It ends with Versailles and the peace treaty, which changed all the frontiers of the Middle East, not of the armistice of November the 11th, 1918. So I think there's an automatic connection between the collapse of industrial civilization and the First World War, and then a peace treaty that was effectively going to collapse the ruins of the Ottoman Empire in 1919. And from that came, as you rightly say, all these borders, not just Yugoslavia and Northern Ireland, but particularly the borders of Iraq and Lebanon and Syria and so on, and Turkey and what is now the Arab world. And I think that, you know, in my whole working life in the Middle East, and indeed also in Yugoslavia and Belfast, I've watched over those 50 years in total, I've watched all the people in those borders burn. I said to my friend in Beirut yesterday that I think the reason we're not finding evidence of COVID-19 among the Middle Eastern people is that for them, it was COVID, not it was COVID-19. It was the Versailles, was the COVID infection of 1919, and that infection continues now to and spread its disease across the Middle East of injustice and lack of independence and lack of freedom. I do very much think that you cannot report a war or go to a war without at least a very good history in your back pocket. And it's not because history repeats itself, which of course it does, though not exactly. It's that without knowing what lies underneath the embers, you don't know why the fire is burning. And, you know, it's very easy for us in a sort of very much post-war world. Let's forget coronaviruses for a moment. You know, a world which in my lifetime, I was not alive in the Second World War. I was born just afterwards. But it was a world that was meant to be getting better. You know, we had the United Nations, the ICRC. We had all kinds of human rights organizations. We had an outbreak of democracy in areas like Latin America we would never have expected. And we had the end of Nazi and fascist dictatorship in Europe. And I suppose fascism or monarchist fascism, if you like, in Japan. And so it was a world that was getting better. But when you go, as I often do, into the alleyways of, well, the Sabra Shatila Palestinian camps in Beirut, for example, and you actually talk to the people there, you realize that they are living in squalor and dirt because Arthur Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, signed the Balfour Agreement in 1917, and because the victorious allies, principally the French and the British, divided up the Middle East. British would have Palestine, French would get Syria and Lebanon in the aftermath of that war. And for those people waking up in their hovels every morning today, Balfour signed the declaration last night. Versailles happened yesterday. And history, in their experience, is something that they are living tactilely and tragically with every day, whereas we people can luxuriate in a post-war world where we have all the values of civilization, or we think we do, and we have all the technology to look after us and the high-class medical dispensaries that can give us long lives, or hopefully so. That's why I suppose it's a bit of a shock to us to suddenly find this sort of Black Death virus comes hovering through the sky and you can't see it. But nonetheless, I think that you cannot dissociate history from the Middle East. And in fact, it's a black and dark history. In that sense, it is a kind of virus, and it has infected every square inch of the lands I work in and write about.
I was just thinking about that Mark Twain quote, "History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes."
Yeah, I've never quite understood what Mark Twain meant by that. It's one of a number of very fine quotations which one nods at sagely but doesn't actually understand. You can explain it to me if you want. No, look, I think that if you want the roots of injustice in any society, you've got to go back. You can't go forward because you don't know what's going to happen. And you can't just abuse the present evildoers of the world who are still alive, because there are reasons why they do evil. And one of the things I think journalists have to do, as well as recognize the goodness of ordinary people, is to try and find out why ordinary people do wicked things. I'm not sure Hannah Arendt in her investigations of Nazism really got an answer to that, except to talk about the banality of evil. I'm not sure evil is banal. It's pretty shocking and outrageous. But I think also we all sort of participate in it in the sense that, you know, we wring our hands with anguish, and rightly so, when a hospital is destroyed in northern Syria. But when a hospital is destroyed in Mosul or Raqqa by an American aircraft, we do not wring our hands. We wait to see if the Americans will give us an explanation, and then we hope that their claim that they didn't hit the hospital is true. Same applies to wedding parties and medical centers in Afghanistan, so on and so forth. And when you consider that up to 500,000 Iraqis might have died as a result of the American illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003, when people used to say to me, why don't you want Tony Blair and George Bush put on trial? I would always say, because they're not going to be put on trial. There's no point in wasting your energies. Now I'm not so sure that would be my reply. I think we're all guilty of mass murder. It depends what we dress it up in.
That idea of waiting for an American explanation was, in fact, the reason that you left the Times, I think, in 1988, when the paper would not print your story about how the United States had shot down an Iranian passenger aircraft, but instead ran an editorial saying that the pilot tried to carry out a suicide attack on the U.S. warship. You immediately quit, did you?
Yes, I tried to immediately. In fact, I made up my mind immediately I would, and within, let me just work out the time sequence, within 5 months I joined The Independent. Just because you leave a newspaper in horror doesn't mean that every other newspaper is going to welcome you there. But I went straight to The Independent and said, I'm looking to work for you. And very shortly they said, yes, please come as our Middle East correspondent. What actually happened then was very simple. I had worked for The Times for many years in Belfast and then in the Middle East. And they'd never changed my copy, never altered a story, even when it conflicted with the editorial views of The Times editors. And then on this one occasion, towards the end of the Iran-Iraq war in 1988, the American destroyer USS Vincennes shot down an Iranian passenger airliner. And I was actually, by chance, I was on holiday here in Ireland, and I rushed to the Gulf within 12 hours and went to see the Dubai air traffic control that monitored all air radio traffic over the Gulf. And because I'd been working with them, because I'd been flying on helicopters and talking to them over the Gulf during the Iran-Iraq war, I knew them all. And I got into the air traffic control center and I went to see my old friends, most of whom actually were Brits. And I said, okay, what happened? They said, the Vincennes panicked. We could hear them panicking. They were challenging every aircraft, however perfect its flight path was. This Iranian aircraft had its equipment was working perfectly. It had already signaled its descent to land in Dubai and then go on to Kuwait. And that, in fact, the same captain of the same American warship had endangered other flights, including British Airways, by challenging them and threatening to shoot them down. And that was obviously the story. And I thought, you know, our readers should know it. And I filed it off from Dubai that night. I got the sources. They were known to me for years. I trusted them. I actually had the quotations from the radio, and the story didn't run. We carried an editorial suggesting it was a suicide pilot. I later met the brother of the pilot and he convinced me his brother was certainly not a suicidal person. And the strange thing was, a couple of days later, I was talking to the editor of a Dublin newspaper called the Sunday Tribune. His name was Vincent Brown, a very fine Irish journalist. Unfortunately, the Sunday Tribune has died in the years since. But he said, listen, I can give you the front page and four pages inside if you'll write your story for us. So I sat down in the Gulf and I wrote the story for this small circulation Irish newspaper, which was very well produced and was a very tough middle-of-the-road paper, Sunday paper. And it printed the lot. So the people of Dublin or County Mayo could read what happened in the Gulf, but the people, readers of the London Times, could not. And I thought, that's the time I go. If I'm going to risk my life for a newspaper, but my editor will not risk his reputation with his owner over a story of mine, then it's time I left.
Who was the editor at that point?
Charles Wilson was his name.
And have you spoken to him since?
He became my editor of The Independent later on.
Yeah. So, how did that work out?
I spoke to him briefly then, but not on that subject. I felt that I had already written in my book the story of what happened and what he said about it on the night, how he said he'd never read such rubbish in all his life. He was a man who gave way, in my view, totally to Rupert Murdoch's ownership of The Times, as many people still do, including on The Times, by the way, although he's long left that. And I was very disappointed in him as a journalist for ethical reasons, for human reasons. I was very sad that he had chosen not to print that story because he knew it was the truth, all turned out to be. In fact, the U.S. Inquiry was at huge length, but it was effectively a carbon copy of what I'd written that night.
I wonder how that works, though. I mean, would Murdoch have put out a kind of policy statement saying...
No.
So it's self-censorship?
It's autocensure, as the French would say. Yeah, it is. A sort of self-censorship. You see, what happens is that I've always believed that journalism should be a profession, but in fact it's a craft. It's okay for artisan work, but it's not a profession. It doesn't have a professional body, I mean, except for a trade union. It doesn't have a list of regulations, although every so often newspapers claim they want to belong to such an institution. And the problem is that once you have a ruthless owner and you know that you're effectively, your livelihood, your money, etc., is in the pocket of that man. And if you're not fortunate enough to have a reputation that can possibly get you another job, let's be fair about it, there is a tendency to start not wanting to rock the boat. I won't use that word if, in fact, we're going to get a lot of complaints from readers or from this pressure group or from this ethnic origin group. And so it's in the journalist's blood, an infection again, perhaps, as it is in the editor's, not to do something which will cause a crisis when you can get the story in some form, not in my case in this particular story. But, you know, that's why you find over and over again that the Israeli wall, which is actually very much in the West Bank, but is supposed to be dividing Israel and the West Bank. The Israeli wall is often referred to as a security fence by journalists. They don't want to offend the Israelis and Israel supporters by calling it a wall, even though it is in fact higher and longer than the Berlin Wall was. That's why we talk about a Jewish settlement in the West Bank, when what we mean is a Jewish colony. The French use the word les colons, a colony. We don't. We call it a settlement, which has a kind of soft impression of, you know, settlements in the Wild West, perhaps. And then, of course, you think of, you know, the Native Americans attacking them. And also, you see, you always have this thing that you must never talk about a war between Israel and the Palestinians. It's always a dispute, which is not. It is virtually a war. It's much more than a dispute. It is one group of people seizing other people's land. And by desemanticizing, because we're frightened of what owners will say or editors will say, by desemanticizing this conflict, by calling a wall a fence, or by calling a conflict a dispute, we effectively say that there must be something wrong when the Palestinians throw stones. They must be generically violent people. So in a sense, we contribute towards warfare by self-censorship.
In the context of the journalistic role to provide balance, your response is, and this is in the documentary, if we were reporting the slave trade, would the slave ship captain deserve as much say? That seems quite extreme.
No, I wouldn't say so. Look, in the same context, if you were a journalist with an advancing army and were liberating a concentration camp or a death camp in Nazi Germany, would you give equal time and balance to the SS for a spokesman to talk about why they'd murdered millions of people in the death camp? No, you wouldn't. When I was present at the Sabra-Shatila massacre, I was actually in that camp before the Falangist murderers left. Christian Lebanese militiamen who'd been sent into that camp by the Israeli army. I did not spend my time giving equal time to the killers. I talked to the relatives of the dead and tried to find the identities of the dead who were lying around me and upon whom sometimes I feel in walking around the camp, I actually trod on their piled corpses. I think my feeling is that you must be neutral and unbiased, but unbiased on the side of those who suffer. You know, the idea that we're some kind of robotic creature that reports wars as if it's a football match, you know, between Manchester United and Newcastle, where you give equal time to each side. The Middle East is a bloody tragedy. It is not a football match. And just as if I walk down a street and I see someone being assaulted on the other side of the street, be I in Beirut or in Dublin, I hope very much I would cross the road and intervene and grab the guy who's assaulting someone. I don't stay on the side of the road and wait till the police come up to give them a balanced version of what I've seen.
Here's the tricky thing, though. If your ethos is that you have to take the side of the victims and the vulnerable, then who is more of a victim and who is more vulnerable than the Jews in World War II?
I think the Jews are the greatest victims of World War II, but this is not World War II today. You know, when Menachem Begin was advancing, or his army was advancing on Beirut in 1982, he said that he felt like Hitler was trapped in Berlin. He meant that Arafat was trapped in Beirut. And Martin Gilbert, one of the finest British historians, who was himself a Zionist and Jewish, he's dead now, and who's written, in my view, the finest history of the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust, wrote to him an impassioned letter saying, please, please stop using World War II. I'm not making the same appeal to you on this program now, but of course, every sane human being will acknowledge the facts of the Holocaust and the guilt of Europe for permitting the Holocaust. It wasn't just the Germans who did it. Remember, the French sent the Jewish children of Drancy off to Auschwitz. The sins of the Second World War are unending. Although I suddenly point out to you, it's interesting that although we would never allow and should never allow the Germans to deny the Holocaust, we do allow the Turkish government to deny their mass murder in the Armenian Holocaust of 1.5 million Armenian Christians in 1915. So even the question you've raised brings up a question of a double standard on the part of our acknowledgements of Holocaust. I do acknowledge the Armenian genocide and Holocaust, and I 100%, I've been to almost every death camp in Europe, and I've written constantly about the Holocaust. And indeed, I'm a member of the Foreign Committee, International Committee of the Institute of Holocaust Studies in Jerusalem, which is an Israeli institution. But that does not mean that I cannot tell the truth about those who suffer in the Middle East today.
Sometimes the truth, of course, is uncomfortable. And the documentary, I'm talking to Robert Fisk, by the way, and there's a new documentary about him called This Is Not a Movie. The documentary talks about the report from Douma in Syria in 2018 that Assad had used chemical weapons. And you ran a story quoting a doctor saying that the respiratory distress causing these allegations was in fact the result of a dust storm.
No, he said that it was a result of a dust storm caused by Syrian Russian bombing.
Yes.
He wasn't denying the Syrians and the Russians as the cause.
No, but he was undermining the idea of chemical weapons.
He was, yes. Now, the other doctors in that hospital were not present when I spoke to that doctor, who was 30 meters away but was at his home during the bombing. They were with the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, and they too, apparently, according to the report by the organization, said that it wasn't gas. Well, they would, you could say, although this particular doctor, who spoke quite good English, was not at all warm towards the Syrian regime. He could have asked me not to use his name and just told me, yes, I think it was gas. But I don't know if Assad used gas in Douma. What I do know, and I went into the underground tunnels of Douma afterwards, is that I found no proof that gas had been used. And we now know, of course, that the subsequent final report of the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons did in fact delete and censor out some of the evidence from some of its own scientists so that it would say that it's an open and shut case that Assad did use gas. In fact, its own staff could not finally prove that gas was used. All I did was simply say, look, the world says it was used. I can't prove it, and I've been there.
It was sarin gas.
And I talked to people in the street who, whom I chose. I mean, there were thousands of people in the street, and I didn't find anyone who had been a witness to a gas attack. Mm. And I mean, you could say, well, you know, Assad's secret service had told them all, but you can't tell thousands of people what to say to a single journalist who wanders around. So I found no such proof. And I think that at a different location in Syria, Assad's forces did use gas. But whether he used it at Douma, I don't know.
So you're in the position of putting up essentially a defense to...
No, there was no defense. I said in the story that I didn't know if he'd used gas. I didn't say he didn't. That would have been a defense. I have no idea.
So you are undermining the claims that Assad used gas and thereby...
No. I never undermined any such claim. I said he may have used it. I don't know. I undermined those who said there was no question that he had.
Yeah.
And claimed that there was proof that he had, because that proof clearly didn't exist. Now we know that the official report had censored out even its own staff when they had raised the same doubts that I had. So I did my journalistic job. They tried to do their job within the organization of prevention of chemical weapons, and they were prevented from doing so. Thank goodness my paper at least ran a story raising the doubts.
I'm not criticizing you. I'm merely pointing out
I know.
That many saw you as in some way providing cover for Assad, for having been duped by the regime.
Of course they would say that. When I was here in Ireland as a reporter, and I wrote a story saying that British troops had beaten up Catholic, innocent Catholic civilians in the streets of New Lodge in Belfast, I was accused by my colleagues and by politicians of being pro-IRA and pro-terrorist. When I reported on the killing of large numbers of Serbs in an RAF attack during the NATO war in Serbia over Kosovo, of course, I was accused by colleagues and by politicians of being pro-Serb and supporting Milosevic. When I pointed out the sins of Abu Ghraib in Syria, I was accused by one of Bush's own staff of being one of a supporter of Saddam Hussein, even though I was actually expelled by Saddam Hussein's government for writing about the murders by his own people of prisoners in Abu Ghraib. So, you know, as I say in the film, if you're going to try and do your job properly and you're going to raise doubts about what, you know, the nomenclatura believe or the government's claim or the people are encouraged to believe, you will always be accused of being pro-Serb or pro-Palestinian or pro-Syrian or pro-Assad or pro-Saddam Hussein or pro-IRA and pro, you know, wherever. And if I do any more stories in the near future, it'll happen again. And you've simply got to bash on and do your best to get at the truth, even though, in my case in Douma, I couldn't establish what it was, at least raise the doubt. You know, I go back to the Second World War, which you brought up earlier, for example, where at the very beginning of the German invasion of the Low Countries, we were given a figure, I think 120,000 dead from Luftwaffe bombing of Rotterdam in Holland, when in fact at Nuremberg it turned out that the figures were much, much smaller. They were less than 20,000. Now, it was still a massacre and it was still committed by the Luftwaffe. It was still a war crime. But one has to keep saying, was that figure accurate? Was that statistic accurate? Did it really happen that way or did it happen somewhere else? And if we don't do that, then we're handing the writing of history to political parties. And I think one of our jobs as a journalist is not to allow politicians to write history.
When you were attacked by Afghan refugees, I think it was in Pakistan the refugees were.
And you right on the border, actually, but it was in Pakistan itself, yes.
You wrote a story which was sympathetic to the refugees who were fleeing US bombing.
And who could not be sympathetic to the refugees?
Well, a Wall Street Journal editorial had a headline, "A self-loathing multiculturalist gets his due." Which
No editorial in the Wall Street Journal said
what
that.
Was
a
it?
Very vicious writer wrote that in the Wall Street Journal shortly before the Wall Street Journal asked me to help them extract one of their own journalists who was in the hands of Islamist extremists. And alas, he was murdered. I tried to help. But it was an extremely, in my view, very vicious journalist who said, in effect, that I was a wimp because I had some sympathy of these people because they'd lost their families. And I had said in my report, as I did, if I had been them, I probably, having lost my family under American airstrike, I might well have attacked Robert Fisk myself.
Who wrote that column?
Do you know, I can't remember. But if you have a copy of my book or you Google it, you could whiz through and find out the name. I'm just trying to remember myself. I don't have my laptop in front of me.
No, as a matter of interest, I wondered whether...
No, it's in my book. He's widely commented on by me at the time. In fact, the book is just in the floor below me and I can't run down and get it.
And I haven't got it to hand
either. I have a feeling
either.
His first name was Mark, but I might be wrong. Mm. Anyway.
Are you... angry now?
About what?
About anything.
I'm regularly angered when I hear Trump lying about coronavirus or Boris Johnson lying about coronavirus and effectively being prepared to kill off the elderly in their countries. That makes me angry. And I'm angry when I see that Netanyahu and Gantz, the sort of prime minister twins who are going to take over in Israel, that they're going to effectively steal more Palestinian Arab land in the West Bank, at least they said they will, by annexing it against all international law. That makes me angry politically and morally, I think. But do I get personally angry? No. I mean, you know, I've been in the Middle East now for 44 years and covering Ireland before that. And I think if you're really going to burn up your energies on having sort of personal feelings about it, I think you're wasting your life. I mean, I think the idea is to try and, you know, every time I'm writing, when I'm writing a story, when I'm writing a comment, I'm trying to write as if I'm writing a letter to a friend, that the readers are friends. And actually, because I do a lot of lectures around the world, not at this actual moment, but normally, I probably meet more readers of The Independent than anyone else on the paper does. And I'm very impressed by how smart they are. They're very educated, much more educated than us writers, I suspect, in many cases. And I think they deserve to have someone who's going to go out into the boondocks and try and tell them what's really going on, as opposed to what the Trumps and the Johnsons and the Blairs and the Bushes and the Putins and indeed the Assads and the Saddam Husseins are claiming. But, you know, you can't do more better than that in a sense. I remember questioning Amira Haas, that great Israeli journalist on Haaretz, who's still living in Ramallah in the West Bank and writing as an Israeli journalist for Haaretz. Both her parents were Holocaust survivors. I said to her, what was our job as foreign correspondents? And she said, our job, Robert, is to monitor the centers of power, especially when they go to war and especially when they lie in order to do so. I thought that was a pretty good explanation of why we should be journalists.
But you put yourself...
But it's not got anything to do with personal anger.
Well, no, but you put yourself at personal risk and you work very hard and occasional vilification and you say... that mostly what we write does not make the slightest bit of difference. So what is it that keeps you going?
Oh, history. You know, I think that watching history actually happen by being on the ground, not by following it on, you know, Google or Twitter or social media, and you can live in Iceland and do that. I think it's a cursed privilege to watch history, but it's something that my father injected me with, the idea that our lives are all about history and that we are living the next bit of history. And I suppose in a very primitive way, and maybe you'd have to be a storyteller to understand this, but for me, it's like reading a great work like War and Peace, for example, and you're sitting up in bed late at night reading it and saying, well, I'll just read one more chapter. And you say, my God, it's 3 o'clock. Well, I'll just finish this chapter. And before you know it, you look up and you see the light coming through the curtains and you realize you've been reading all night. And the reason is you want to see what happens next. And that, I suspect, is what I want to do. I'm always wanting to know what happens next.
Mark Steyn.
That's it. You got it. Well done. You see, you've got your Google there, and here am I. All I've got in front of me is a pen and a piece of paper.
Not Mark only Steyn. Do I...
It's probably not, Steyn, actually, he pronounces it. But
I believe it's Steyn.
E-Y-N.
But not only do I have Google, but I have very well-informed listeners.
Very good. Well, excellent. They're spot on. And they can look up the article in question. I've written about it too. I think in many other articles he's written, he's proved to be a very ruthless and cruel journalist. But there are plenty of them around, and people call me ruthless and cruel. So there's nothing new in that.
People do call you ruthless and cruel, particularly Israelis. Are you welcome in Israel?
I haven't actually ever met an Israeli who's called me ruthless and cruel. I've met Arabs who have, and I've met Europeans who have, but I've never received anything but politeness anywhere in Israel.
How interesting.
Look at the film. I actually have a long interview, don't I, with a Jewish settler.
Yes, a very interesting interview.
And who actually says at one point to me, to my amazement, the Palestinians are so passé, they're so 20th century.
Yes.
I stood there, I thought, I can't believe you've just said that. Look, I go in and out of Israel without any problems. I'm always treated extremely politely. I'm always given an extended press card, which is unusual for a visiting journalist. And I always stay at the King David Hotel, which is in West Jerusalem, in the Jewish part of Jerusalem. And I've never, ever had a bad word said to me by any Israeli. And I've always been welcome in their homes, and I've always reported on them and gone to see them. I mean, I do stories when I go to Israel about Israel, not just about Palestinians. Although, of course, I go to Gaza, I go to the West Bank, I go to Golan sometimes. But I've never, you see, your automatic assumption there is that Israelis have called me ruthless and cruel. That's never, ever happened. That's very cruel of you to say that Israelis would say such things. They want to argue or talk or discuss, but they don't talk like that.
And your Israeli settler said to you, if Palestinians can prove that they own the land, they should be compensated, sure. Implying, of course, that they didn't own the land and there were no such things as Palestinians. And you immediately cut the documentary, cuts to Suleiman Khatib, who lost his house to the Israelis. And
no, I didn't cut. You've got to realise...
The documentary cuts,
the film was
yes.
made. It's a documentary cuts at that point. Actually, it cuts a little bit after that when he asks about journalism and Israel. It does go on a little bit further. I didn't have anything more to say to him when he said that, because my view was, I'm not going to start arguing with him. He knew very well that, of course, Palestinians have land deeds to the land, and of course they owned it. And in fact, the very bit of that settlement we were standing in had a Palestinian owner who had been dispossessed. I mean, he knew that, and I know that. But it seemed to me it was necessary to let him say that. And then for the viewer, I didn't know whether it would be after him or before him, of course, because I didn't make the film, would hopefully see the story of the family that was dispossessed from that land upon which I first interviewed them 25 years earlier.
It's a very interesting documentary, and I'm glad that you allowed it to be made, and I'm glad that we're going to be able to see it. And it's been very good talking to you, Robert Fisk.
And you too. A great pleasure.
Thank you. Robert Fisk is the subject of a documentary called This Is Not a Movie, and it will be part of an online Doc Edge Festival. Details on our webpage.